Blog Talk Radio.
Listening to sounds from 1924 is sort of puts me in the mind for this program. I think it has I listened to it because it has currency. What, that's John Oliver's band, and a little trumpet player, of course, is Louis Armstrong. But it puts me in a state of mind. There are things that do that, the experiences that we have, and places, scenes, and situations that we find ourselves in. And you've joined us again today here on Masonic Effects. And I'm so pleased and grateful that you're here. Absolutely, I want to just bring you into a better understanding of who the listeners are. We're getting listeners from India, from Norway, from Russia, France, Britain. Soon, if Brexit does proceed, I imagine I'll be acknowledging Ireland and Scotland separate and apart. I don't mind doing that now. And England. The United States, and ultimately Canada, and Brazil. So we're reaching around the world, and I'm grateful. Today, I think we're going to have things that I notice, and I need your help. I certainly need your advice as Masonically oriented people. We're navigating in interesting times. Is there any period that isn't interesting? Is there any period where, you know, we can be that smug where we can look back and say, oh, that was altogether boring? It seems if you're uneducated about the events of the period, we can certainly get away with saying that. Or if we're rash enough just to be, you know, that youthful rashness where certain things matter and certain things just don't matter. And we're living very much in the moment and exploring. Everything's opening up around us. And we have the energy and that tabula rasa, that open canvas. You know, we're going to paint on it. What a journey. So here, Masonic Effects, it really is maybe a refutation. I like that. A refutation of... or a clarification that no one can take us by the hand and lead us through life, no one or no thing. That's for us to do, to assimilate all of the information around us and make the best decisions that we can in whatever way that we do that the best. But isn't it curious? We're going to have, I think you're going to enjoy the commentary today as much as I did writing it and pulling it together. We're in interesting times on this 239th day of 2017. Lots going on. I hope you're informed as much as you need. And I hope in some ways, you're able to separate out the news from the media feed and make those determinations. What's news to you? That there is a battlefront somewhere? Well, it's not really news that the population of the world is engaged in conflict, but is it news where that conflict is and how it's developed? Well, the historic presence is interesting. Time and time again, I would recommend, in my own mind, I go back to the work the book 1919. It was published a couple of years ago. If you can get your hands on a copy of it, it's compelling reading because it explains the settlement of the world after the First World War. And I won't try and convince you of this, but I'd like you to read it and form your own opinion because in my mind, it explained, it was one of those aha explanations. It explained so much about what is going on internationally today. Yeah. So there you have it. I'm going to start the program with something really interesting. You know, who listen to some jazz. That I've unilaterally declared is the music of the world. here's why. This is East Meets West Fusion by Ashwin Batish and Kuambah Jazz, called the Kasbah Shuffle Sitar. And, you know, reaching out to this is from earlier concert, but listen to it and see what you make of it. It's I find it quite reasonable and entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
It gets better. It gets better. That's Ashwin Batiste. It doesn't fit. You tell me. Is there a place for in a classic instrument like the sitar in jazz? All you have to do is try it. Hmm? So what else is new? Like so many other things in life, one of the very important aspects of masonry is self-improvement. Although this isn't a competition, saying that, it doesn't mean that we all subscribe to it. This hopefully it never turns into, well, it can't be anything totalitarian. You know, here's the orthodoxy, follow it or you're out. much more interesting. It's like playing the music and then understanding. This is like listening to Thelonious Monk and then trying to understand the music, or Chet Baker or Miles Davis, or, you know, Paul Desmond, Christian McBride. To listen is one thing, to experience it, to feel your foot tapping to the rhythm, you know, that sound that emulates the heartbeat, that just makes you bob and weave. And if you're a classicist, even more pronounced. Well, the more we study the classics, the more I think that it enriches the experience for all music. When you hear the voice, you know, the diva talking about the voice as the instrument, you know, that is such an unusual level of respect. That's not common in our world. What is common is that I have a tickle in my throat. I have to do something about it. Like that. Here. A little bit on the commentary today. What takes us, compels us to self-improvement is, I think, underlined by, as if you're inclined, underlined by the sense that to get there, to embrace the, we'll call it the so-called Masonic values, although I feel a more personal connection to that, and I'm sure some of you do. But it's like saying the so-called ideas of the Reformation or the Counter-Reformation. It's like, okay, where are you going with that? But the ideas are this: to make gains with improvement is one needs to realize, or one comes to realize eventually, that it requires authenticity from us, from you and me. And then the questions: how then can one be authentic? How can one know that they're being authentic without exploring or observing themselves? The contemplation: why did I say that? What was the meaning? What came out of it? And is that introspection plagued with burdens of incomplete processes from our earlier childhood? Yeah, but if we're starting to declare that, you know, we have that ability to selectively embrace amnesia, then it's easy to do that. Oh, that doesn't exist because I'm uncomfortable, you know. Mathematics is hard because I had very poor instructors. Science is boring. Can you imagine, eh? Science is boring. Well, the way we've emphasized, what we're seeing, the unpleasantness around us, is the mirror it's reflected what we've created, we collectively. I see people of color and women and the LGBT community loudly professing their platform. And I wasn't clear, the message is sort of obvious, but I wanted to understand it more than the obvious. And I became to realize, understanding as a Mason, I think, that these were people that weren't sure they were being heard or identified, or that their issues were valued. And yeah, sometimes I get impatient about that. Think, oh, I'll move on. You know, well, yeah, I'm not part of that racial group, so my issue is quite different. And I'm a male, so my issue is different. And I'm a Mason, and I'm an old man. So the way I look at the world is different, I hope. But I realized that what these good people were saying to me is that, can we connect? And what they needed to hear was something that Masons can do easily. We can reassure. We can reassure. If there is a problem, we'll look into it and we'll fix it. We'll do the right thing. And we'll connect as human beings. It's hard, though. It's hard. Because sometimes we're working on problems that are systemic. Or they come from values that have passed. Oh, I know the media is talking today about, you know, the problem, the slippery slope of applying today's values and morals to history. Well, that's what I do. It's what you do each and every day. I'm trying to assimilate these things. Oh, well, and when I become troubled and I become ridiculous, I sound it. The barrier to understanding is, again, staring us square in the face. Go and find a mirror and look at it. That's the barrier. That's the barrier. It's understanding. So how do we round out that authentic human being that everybody can ascribe to? Everybody. In their own way. Everybody's trying to get by, do the best they can. Can we do it in Plato's cave? Can we sit there in the cave looking at shadows on the back of it over the edge as the world goes on around us? Can you do that? Can we do this and achieve growth by living inside our own head all the time? You know, overthinking everything. Well, what imbalance is the difference between overthinking and understanding? We begin to find some answers by, you know, embracing ideas of the Zen, I think. Does your faith, does your belief, does your sense of purpose present barriers for you? Or as Masonry subscribes, do you feel at all liberated by history, by the release, as Hegel has said, of this of freedom and reason? History, that's the purpose of history, according to the function of history. We do this. Isolation. I think we can admit that we are. Excuse me. We're social animals. We like groups. Whether we like to be quiet and sit in the periphery, or we've subscribed to the what North America has hailed as the purpose or function. Everything is groups. And competition, and the loudest is right. And the competition for experience is best. So climb that mountain, swim that ocean. The more that you do, the better off you know, the better you are. Except at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't. What matters is whether there was purpose to it all. So we do this. We step forward. Masonry, if you haven't noticed, doesn't take you by the hand and underline when you open the book. It doesn't have the lines underlined, the important parts underlined. This isn't like a study hall. Doesn't even have the book, does it? It gives us a ritual that helps us connect to something. Something outside of ourselves. That's ritual. But the meaning, here, right here beside me, there's my paintbrush. So I give you a fistful of brushes and some color. And that's Mason. That's what masonry does. Here. Now, does it teach you how to be a draftsman or draftsperson? Draftsman. Does it teach you how to draw? Does it teach you the meaning of a cartoon? Or are we thinking it's something for children on television? Does it reflect an understanding that artists are attempting to interpret and highlight some importance for the viewer? Degas, see? Van Gogh, that's for me. You know? When all of a sudden I became a bit snooty, I used to think when I was a boy, you know, I'm born on an island. And simple, hardworking, honest people taught me, raised me. But I didn't have opinions about art. That was for somebody else. Now, at my age, I've become a bit more discriminating. There's things I think is junk. And I remember Terry Ryan. Maybe some of you have heard of Terry and his work with the Inuit and the preservation of Inuit art, the expression of Inuit art around the world. And Terry, lovely man. Shout out to you, Terry. When I was faced with all of this carving and prints, and what do I decide? You know, somebody's trying to sell me their wares at the door, if you can imagine. I was in an art community. It's fabulous, fabulous experience in the high Arctic, in the Arctic. And he said, it is, you know, what's good? I wanted to know what's good, what makes a carving good. And he said, it's what you think it is. That. And then I was like, oh my goodness, I was so embarrassed. Not anymore. You become more discriminating and selective about the world around you. What is proper? What is pleasant? What is gentlemanly? Are we all together purposefully muscular as in our attitudes toward one another? Somehow this doesn't seem to fit. We all have a past. Oh, isn't that an ominous word? We all have a history. But when we call it a past, it takes on a je ne sais quoi. It's great. So we've learned, I believe, as you're doing here today, and hopefully we'll facilitate that, by reading about other experiences and other people. And how do we do that? We can begin by picking material that has stood the test of time. So you read about, you know, and that takes a lifetime, I think. I'm waiting to tuck into the Peloponnesian Wars. And you've heard me chatter away about the work on essential writings of Machiavelli. Why would this be? Or you know, why William Blake? Why? Because reading about, is particularly reading biographies, and reading significant work by a single mind, important minds, thinkers, helps us to orient ourselves. Do we read about Marx according to the government's politicized propaganda? Ideas around us have become weaponized. and we can be, if we aren't immediate to condemn certain ideas, we can be caught up in an unusually tight net. So if we don't have to worry anymore, brethren, about whether Masonry is facing a pivotal change, it's already begun. It's already begun. And we're doing remarkably well with it. Here's a jazz improvisation. After this performer did a classical recital. Was he doing Ravel, I think, in Russia, back in St. Petersburg, on the 14th of July, 2015. And after, the audience was just, you know, amazed. They just wanted more. This is Lucas DeBauche, and this is a little jazz improv from the classical musician. What do you think? I think you'll like it. Let me get this, find this for you. Beautiful. Is that a game changer? I don't know. I just don't know. I just don't know. See, it explains something to us, doesn't it? This order that you profess to be enjoying and engaging with all of the intrigue that we can muster makes it much more. It's like, you know, takes us away from the boredom of life, and it opens up us to a whole different way of thinking. We also experience the outcome of diplomacy. I was reading an article a couple of days ago from a young man about the need to defend the order from the criticism. He'd been surfing around on the internet and reading material, and he was finding it, you know, he was finding it uncomfortable, and thought that we should, you know, his words were full of the robustness of the dilettante. We're being attacked, and he felt that we needed to have a concerted response. And I thought the beauty of it is this young man is processing. Masonry is not known for being rash. And that's not to say we haven't. It gives us a chance to sit back and think and begin to understand the appropriate kind of an answer. But that takes us to into a world of insight. You know, if we're going to develop, we're going to embrace this whole metaphor about searching for the light. It seems to be based on an interesting fulcrum. On one end is knowledge, and on the other is understanding. Knowledge you gain from study and observation. Yes, it's just like your parents and teachers often said to you, pay attention. You're walking through, if you've walked through the life with your head in the clouds up till now, it's not a problem, just pay attention. What do you pay attention? What should gain your attention? That's on you. What's important? What's basic? What's revealing? If you start to look at the world around you as if it all has meaning and it all has importance, then it gives us, everything has purpose. Huh? If you're walking, and these are very, very old thought exercises, thousands of years old. If you're walking down the street, it's the experience of the moment, the feel of the air on your skin, the smells, and the sounds around you. Is it snow crunching under your feet? Is it the wind coming at you over the dune? Is it the grains of sand? Is it the crunch of shells on the beach? The sounds of the waves crashing? The wind's howling up the side of the mountain. Does it have any meaning to you? Well, if you think it doesn't, then it doesn't. You think it doesn't, then it's the moment is lost. It doesn't have to be. Oh, yes. It doesn't have to be. There are some things that are important. So here I want to put this to you, the audience, and the tune in. This is a little something I was reading about Alexander Pushkin, and I don't know if I have to apologize for going back to the work of a poet like Pushkin. I hardly think so. It's like apologizing for looking at Michelangelo's work or Da Vinci's work or, you know, listening to Chopin or Shostakovich. Never. But this is a comment I want you to, I'm going to read a bit of his work, but in this context, Pushkin created the Russian literary language, was the founder of modern Russian literature, and made humanity the richer for his immortal works. It's that last one. Now, it's not to say we only listen to one bit of this and it can define this man to us, but made humanity the richer for his immortal works. Pushkin's name is inseparably bound up not only with literature, but also with the whole Russian culture. Who wouldn't be fascinated a bit? Again, read 1919. So here's I find his work quite compelling. So this is My Friend I Have Forgotten. Okay? He wrote this in 1821. My friend, I have forgotten all that's past. The passion of my youth was rather brief. Don't ask about the things that didn't last, or how I felt in the times of joy or grief, or what I loved, or how I was betrayed. I may not know true happiness today, but you are innocent, conceived for only bliss. Believe in it and seize each moment's portion. Your soul was made for friendship and devotion, to feel the passion of a kiss. Your soul is pure and unexposed to sadness. Your conscience is still clear like light of day. Why listen to the lunacy and madness of all of my uninteresting hearsay? It will replace your peaceful thoughts with stress. Your heart will tremble. You will cry in bed. Your soul will lose its trust in its distress. Perhaps my love will fill you with regret. Who knows? Perhaps forever. No, my dear, I fear to cast my final happiness away. Don't ask for dangerous confessions here. Today, I love. I'm happy for today. So, does it work? Is this the kind of a person that can write that? The kind of person that can make humanity richer for the experience? Pushkin's not with us. Anyway, Alexander Pushkin, Mr. Pushkin's not with us anymore. Died in a duel. He had many duels. Died of injury, I think. Somebody can correct me out there. But the experience. What does that give you and I? Why are these things important? Well, if we read a bit about we all may have heard E equals MC squared, right? Energy, the speed of light, mass. But when we read about, understand the lives and the development of these creators, Faraday, Tesla, Einstein, it helps us, I think, in some ways, to erase the sense of advantage. Was it more difficult in the 18th and 19th century to be a student or a professor? Well, the connection, of course, the connection, the PhD, is whether you in the 18th century made a contribution. Now, I don't think we need to be defensive anymore, brethren, about the contribution of our order. I don't think so, but we can continue to feel that way, that we must. Different jurisdictions, if you noticed, different jurisdictions exercise the expression of Masonry in their culture in interesting but similar kinds of ways. It's inevitable when you examine the uniqueness of history and how that has a bearing on the people in those cultures, that the meaning will have be nuanced by language, and by history and by the experience of the people. And it ebbs and flows. We don't wake up every morning of our life 100% in touch and aware. Here I can talk about, you know, that sort of an essential measurement, 100%. I have no idea what the hell that is. I have no idea. I think it means all or most or optimal. Well, let's work at an optimal level. I have no idea what the hell that is. Does it mean working with some degree of pace? Well, not entirely. We're not machines. Or does it mean only doing things and studying things that give some profit, only socializing with some people that can benefit you and I? Really? That would be like saying, well, there's nothing emerging. There's no cubism. There's no romantic period. Everything is as it was. There's no dilettante. There's nothing that challenges us. Nothing that rattles us to the core. Well, any new and any change is always heralded by this pushback. This pushback. I don't like that kind of art because it's a misuse of color or form. You know, we use the metaphors. Or if you're not for me, you're against me. I know. Really, people say that and they think that and they mean that. But listening to people very much in earnest telling me that mankind walked on the face of the earth with the dinosaurs. I don't know, a couple of hundred million years in there. That's quite unaccounted for. Maybe we put a bridle on them and rode them around. Huh? Science is hard on us, isn't it? It's one thing that we can do. You can have your own, and will have your own opinions about masonry. I'm hoping that I can bump them just slightly or compliment them, I hope. Or encourage. But science doesn't allow a big argument. It sort of is what it is. It's hard because some of it is complicated to understand. Some of it is not so complicated. But it's observation, isn't it? You look at the stars and you look at them. And how did people calculate we just had an eclipse. How did the early scientists even calculate that year by year? Those things aren't happening every year, huh? How did they notice those things? Sharing information? Well, the traders brought a lot of information with them when they hit port. They picked up ideas and material. Books, scripts, scrolls from their journey and pass those ideas on. There's no way that we can really dominate ourselves. Is there? There's no way anymore that we can do that. So if you're looking for a little bit more on this, you know, be careful about, if you're trying to plunge into doing it right, be careful. You know, Moore taught us in Utopia that it comes at a price. We need that uniformity. You want things to run efficiently, and you want a smile on everybody's face, and then there needs to be uniformity. And that means there's an in-group and an out-group, and there's limits. Everything comes at a price. You walk through the forest, we cut down the natural forest, and we plant one type of tree, and we plant them in convenient rows. convenient for harvesting, convenient for travel. Or we walk through life in a mixed forest where we have young and old, we have oak and elm and poplar and birch and pine and spruce and palm. What is the sense behind that uniformity? What are we giving up is what I'm asking you. I'm not altogether sure of that myself. Here, a little something from Paris.
Thank you.
Just a little bit of that gypsy kind of Django Reinhardt guitar in the background, yeah? And a contemporary workup and by Zaz, one of my favorites, as you know. Every so often there's stuff about out of our history that's kind of interesting. So I'm going to finish today with a little bit of a tease. We have, let me set this up by through the commentary today. I've titled this Shareholders and Stakeholders. Definitely need your help with this one, boys and girls. We think on an organization level and function individually. It came about by providing a format for discerning gentlemen to discuss ideals. And I dare say those conversations went on with bright women too. Wives, partners, sisters, mothers. Some tested the boundaries for propriety in the day. No organization can claim to spontaneously exist. No Big Bang. Oh, it's allergy season. No Big Bang. The evolution of masonry has been the interest of historians and antiquarians for centuries. Philosophers tracing the evolution of thought gave reason to reflect on the orthodoxy of masonry with the development of reason. The 19th century showed us that some had mastered the purpose of history. For George Hegel, history reveals the actualization of freedom. We learn from history that we do not learn from history. Masonry has thrived in various settings because the planks in which it was built are flexible. People have agency. And as a result, we exist in a multitude of cultures. Societies express norms and mores that may not always be obvious, so imposing an ideology has always failed. The engine for our vitality is change. Change cannot be stopped. It is as inevitable as our own mortality. A culture is a culture is a culture. All societies provide elemental functions necessary to the stability and sustainability. Are all people the same? They all contain 11 organ systems, but each has a history unique to that individual. Each has a personality. Are they the same? If we parse out what similarities there are, it does not necessarily define the person. Unless we want to believe that you and I are residual, left behind when all other aspects are calculated. So asking the question allows us to consider who it is that benefits from Masonic principles. Do we perform with the needs in mind of shareholders or stakeholders? Are corporate goals kept in balance with the needs of stakeholders like us? Are we an audience or actors on the stage? Now, I wrote that a couple of weeks ago, and it has bearing. It speaks to me. Are we? The shareholders in us will be thinking about trying to perpetuate an image in our mind, a construct that is put together of slivers and probably the translations of other people about what we are. Or if we focus our minds as stakeholders, the beneficiaries, the purpose of masonry, well, that's hard to understand. That there's no separation. We're not in the audience. We're not in the orchestra pit. We're not on stage. we're all in this together. In my mind, I always think of the Greek agora. We're in the marketplace. We're being influenced. That's where the laws are created and exercised. That's where the politics is being discussed. That's where change is impacting on us, all from all directions, at all times. Never stops. Always has. Always will. But I promised to talk to you a bit about some of these pearls that masonry contains over the ages. And here's one that I just find it kind of compelling. Keep this in the back of your mind. You're the same or are we different? But this is about the art of memory. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, in masonry, memory, for purposes that I won't get into here, like it is important. I would say that that's sort of a universal, wouldn't you? Memory is important in all walks of life. But where in the world would you have a chance to discuss it? Musicians know it. Artists know it. Mathematicians know it. School children know it. Political correctness aside, it's important. And it being able, I have a good friend who recites the most curious snippets of poetry. I just find it fascinating. And I'll finish the show today with a bit of his one of his most recent that he quoted for me. He reminded me of is a little piece by Saxon White Kessinger. She's no longer alive, but I think you'll get it when I bring it up. The pearl. Back to the pearl. I'm like a magpie here, Graham. My gosh. The art of memory, this latter requirement to test the art, craft, and science and ancient memory of Masons has been taken to suggest that Masons may have had to study what the late Dame Frances Yates called the art of memory. I already like this. Stevenson took the view that the cultivation of this art may have represented a genuine Renaissance cultural input into the craft. Go on, you say. In consideration of which, the Scottish craft may have also been open to other more esoteric branches of Renaissance philosophy, such as Rosicrucianism or related hermetic strands. I can only say, if you're curious, by all means, follow up on that. It is fascinating and rewarding. Stevenson, in The Origins of Freemasonry, writes, "The reference to the art of memory in the Second Statutes provides the only direct evidence, as opposed to strong circumstantial evidence, that in remodeling the Mason craft, William Scott was deliberately introducing Renaissance influences into the craft. And for that reason, it is immensely important." Well, I should not suppose the Scottish craft to have been immune to the cultural influences of the time. This was, after all, the late Elizabethan period. It's hard to be convinced that the test of memory really adds up to an importation of Renaissance art of memory. The art of memory, advocated as a form of metaphysical psychology by the Dominican friar Giordano Bruno, he was born 1548 and he passed away in 1600, was linked to his belief that the magus could stand foursquare upon earth with his higher mind illuminated by celestial and solar influences. The Italian Bruno was the first person to promote the idea that the universe was infinite, containing many worlds and beings currently unknown to us, and he was persecuted for it, make no mistake. The Magus could, in potentia, link his mind to an infinite space and total energy of the universe, present at a single point. I dare say Scott had heard of the Nolan, as he liked to be called. Bruno was a famous visitor to England during the 1580s, and Scott had visited France, where Bruno was also active. But this is just conjecture. They may have met. Bruno took the old medieval Lullian art, of integrating knowledge and complex mind pictures away from its basis as an aid to memory function. This is a technique that's still taught today. Through visual links and associations placed in the imagined theater construction and on towards an illuminist parapsychology. So you associate certain ideas with certain concrete experiences, like the rooms of a cathedral. And then you pull up the memory of that room and the information that you're wanting to recall will be attached to that. It's a way of providing access, and you can add multiple layers of information that way. But Bruno's meditation and archetypal talismanic images could, in theory, lead the mind from this shadow world of Earth towards an ideal world experienced in cosmic states of consciousness. This is the art of memory at its most florid, esoteric, and exalted. Bound into pictures of God's creative nature, Kabbalistically expressed. However, this occult system was surely well beyond the capacities of most masters, wardens, and apprentices of stonemasons' lodges. Even had it been a private interest of the most daring and gifted masters, it was an unlikely candidate for a national Masonic curriculum. That some Masons may have employed some kind of imaginative memory theater to help them remember their lines or positions in a lodge is, of course, perfectly possible. It is also possible that the convening of one of these Scottish lodges required a kind of imaginative effort to render it into a more symbolically attuned environment, reaching to the heavens. See, think it over. Did ska bring that Renaissance influence? There were influences, obviously, in Masonry formed before we had constitution. It's like then you have the shell of the operation and the architecture, and then you create the content, yeah? And the content influences the purpose for the architecture. So, to each one of you, I read to you the work of Saxon White Kessinger, perhaps her most famous piece. It's called The Indispensable Man. And here, I'm one. Sometime when you're feeling important, sometime when your ego's in bloom, sometime when you take it for granted you are the most qualified in the room, sometime when you feel that you are going that would leave an unfillable hole, just follow these simple instructions and see how they humble your soul. Take a bucket and fill it with water and put your hand in it up to the wrist. Pull it out, and the hole that's remaining is a measure of how much you will be missed. You can splash all you wish when you enter. You may stir up the water galore, but stop and you'll find that in no time it looks quite the same as before. The moral of this quaint example is to do just the best that you can. Be proud of yourself, but remember, there's no indispensable man.
Mon père entre sous tous les soirs, et pour nous nourrir tous les quatre, ma pauvre mère travaille au lavoir. Quand je suis malade, je reste à ma fenêtre, je regarde passer les gens d'ailleurs. Quand le jour vient à disparaître, il y a des choses qui me font un peu peur. Dans ma rue, il y a des gens qui se promènent. Les enfants chuchotent et dans la nuit, quand on s'endort, bercé par une rengaine, je suis soudain réveillée par des cris. Écoute, si ça